Anita, how's your mental health?
Questionable at all times, you know this.
Yeah, how's the mental health of your children?
Also a little bit tricky. Can I tell you my experience in trying to find therapists for myself and my kids, Mel?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is how it goes. You ask around your friends and your family for a referral for somebody who's nearby. You finally find somebody who sounds like they might work for your family. You give them a call and you find out that A, they're not accepting new patients, or B, they have a huge wait list. So you start over again and you ask people if they know anybody who would be a good therapist and a good fit. Finally, you find one, you go and you meet with them, and you figure out that you don't actually like them that much. But it's been so much work to find somebody who you can go to in your area that you're kind of stuck with them. Well, do you have any ideas for how to get around this?
I do because guess what? I've actually had some therapists that I have found on my own, which involves what you're saying. Sometimes I remember one time I was like 3 hours in the bathtub on my phone looking through websites. I was such a prune at the end. But I have also had the experience with working with BetterHelp, and it was like I don't want to say too good to be true, but because it is true, but it's like amazing because I was matched with my therapist within 24 hours.
And you didn't have to go through all of that other ridiculous process of trying to find somebody. And here's the cool thing, too, is if that person didn't work out for you, you can just switch and say, and it's not like you're committing to another years long search for somebody who you're going to jive with.
That's true. And I lucked out, or maybe just BetterHelp is really good at matching people together because I never had to change my therapist. I loved her, perfect fit for me. And I know that some of our friends have used BetterHelp and they've had to change therapists, and boom, same day, you can change.
Easy
You can ghost your therapist, get a
peasy.
new one.
I love this idea. BetterHelp is one of our sponsors. If you use our promo code trybetterhelp.com/WWDN, you get 10% off your first month, and we totally recommend it.
Yes, get some therapy. That's
Ha.
trybetterhelp.com/WWDN. Well.
Well, what have we here? When one of my kids was younger, he had this really deep voice and he'd go, well, what have we
When one
here?
of your kids was younger?
Yeah.
Whoa.
I have a video, I'll show it to you one time. Well, what we have here?
Well, we're both recovering from last night's Zoom dance party.
Two Zoom dance parties in one day.
True.
Yeah. Needed some ibuprofen and some ice after that.
Everybody, Anita rode bikes for 4 hours on the mountain, up a mountain, then came to two Zoom dance parties.
It was fun though. Thanks everybody who joined us and danced and changed it up a little bit. We were explaining to the people who came that it wasn't just because we wanted to do something fun, but that when you do something novel and that is out of your normal pattern, sometimes it helps your brain to break out of the pattern that it's in. And I actually, my daughter and I use this all the time when she's feeling like she's on the verge of a panic attack or feeling a lot of anxiety. We'll turn on our like a song and dance to it, and it helps her to pull out of that. So there's some method to our
And
madness.
also, if you read The Body Keeps the Score, there's a whole section in there about rhythm and the brain. So it is helpful for traumatic memory. Yay, dancing!
So we're not just crazy people. I mean, a little bit, but not entirely.
TBD for me.
What else is happening, Mel?
Everybody. Red alert.
Aruga, aruga.
We have another holiday coming up that is centered on being a parent, and that might be a hard time for many of us. Take it over, Anita.
There are many more widows than there are widowers, so this one might be particularly difficult to celebrate a person who is dead and watch everybody else around you celebrate their alive person. I'm curious to know what all y'all do for that day. Do you ignore it? Do you do something special? Do you have some sort of a tradition? Is it your first Father's Day? Tell us somehow.
And if you are a widower and your person is gone, and this is an extra sensitive holiday for you as well, High five to you. Go eat a sandwich. We're sorry. Sucks.
And buy yourself your own present. That's what I did for Mother's Day. I was like, I'm buying myself a present for myself, and I'm getting whatever I want.
Now's that time to buy yourself an electric guitar.
That's exactly what I bought myself. As this week might be a little bit difficult before our next episode comes out, reach out in the Widow Wives Club. Let's see what we can do to support one another and make it so it's not just a terrible experience for all. And if you've got a really great tradition that makes it not such a hard day, I'd like to hear about that too in the Widow Wives Club or just on our Facebook page.
Yes, we love hearing from you and we love having everybody interact. We've had some good conversations, especially lately. Yeah. We were talking about guilt, kind of the after mm-hmm. our widowsode, we had a lot of conversation about that. So fun to open those up. Not fun, but fun. Y'all know what I mean.
Yeah. So check out the Widow Wives Club. It's on Facebook. Just search in the search bar for Widow Wives Club and then answer all the questions and you can come join us in all of our discussions.
Excellent. Are you doing anything to prepare for this week? Because you do have the Father's Day situation.
I was actually surprised that my kids were on top of it enough to realize that Father's Day was coming up. And they have been showing some signs of nervousness and anxiety around that. Even my younger ones, even my 7, almost 8-year-old asked me about it today.
What kinds of things are coming up for them?
Just this morning, we record this on Sunday. He said, is today Father's Day? And I said, no. And he said, oh, good. And I was like, huh.
Oh.
Interesting.
When they're at church, do they make little things for their dads? And
yes, yes. And
oh,
they,
man.
And they prepare a song to sing to the dads. So I think that we're going to skip church and just not be there for that. Because it's a hard day. Yeah.
Anita, I think that you and I are cursed. You know why?
Why?
Another person that grew up in our neighborhood that's around our age became a widow this week.
I know.
Another. This is like 5. You guys, our neighborhood is not big. It's like 2 blocks.
I think we've asked this before, though. Do you think that it really is happening a lot, or do you think that we're just more aware of it?
That's what I was wondering, too. And I think it's actually, in my circumstance, happening a lot.
Okay.
I went down my list of friends that I'm close with. Only one has lost a parent and more than one has lost a spouse. So
yeah.
Maybe I'm the magnet. Maybe I'm the issue.
Mel.
Guys, don't be my friend.
Don't live by Mel. She'll curse
no.
you. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, that's whenever we hear about that happening, it's this immediate like, no. And then like tell their spouse that we're here for them, you know.
Yes.
We're here.
When
come
they
find
need us.
Mm-hmm.
But don't bother them too much because they're stressed out.
Yeah.
And very, very, very sad.
Ugh. It's so terrible. I got to come to one of your performances this week, Mel.
Oh,
that
yes.
was fun. We came. It was at an outdoor mall in Salt Lake, and they have one of those water fountain features that squirts.
Splash pad.
Splash pad that squirts water up, and the kids can play. So my kids played in that. While Mel played, and it was fun.
Yeah. Jazzy did her gig. It was her first gig since her person died in January, and she killed it. Okay, no pun intended.
Oh, bad choice of words. Or good choice of words, yeah.
So we were joking. We were like, oh, we could call this the Two Widow Band. There's only 4 of us, and half of us are widows, so yeah. But it was... it was good. Thanks for coming. And I always like doing gigs where it's family friendly so that more people can come. So extra bonus that there was a splash pad. And some other widow friends came too and we got to see them. So thanks everybody that came out, supported.
Yep.
And
just by the way, whoever owns the candy shop right next to the splash pad is a genius because I ended up getting annoyed into buying, berated, I don't know, pressured into buying these sodas that were flavored bacon, dill pickle, and birthday cake. And they were not good. Even the birthday cake was bad.
But what makes you think that those would have been good?
Well, because I like bacon. So if it's just
as
like
a soda.
If it was just sweet bacon in liquid form, yum.
Ew!
I like pickles.
Do you drink pickle juice?
I have, yeah.
Okay, you know what you could have done now that you, if you have a hankering for pickle soda, go get some mineral water and put it in pickle juice and then drink it. Everyone listening's like, please stop. Guys, do you want to have lots of fun and hang out with us and have extra special content? If so, join our Patreon. Levels start at $5 and go up from there. We have the widow friend, the widow bestie, the widow wife, and the dead husband levels. So go to patreon.com/WWDN to check it out. We have so much fun in there. And if you don't want to, that's also totally fine. But one of the things that you do get if you do join the Patreon at a certain level is a shout out in episode, which we are going to do right now. Take it away, Anita.
We're going to start with our secret dead husband. And she says, when the going gets tough, the widows are tougher.
Go, widows, go. Thank you to our secret dead husband. Next, we have Constance Dahlbach.
David Kelly, congrats on your first 10K medal.
Don Satterwhite.
Ivan the Meisner. TMTM.
Jet Setter.
Yeah.
Cat the Cat.
Amy.
Amy Sapp.
Ashley Hahn. I said it right this time. You're welcome.
Christina Shiflett.
Mindy Holmgren.
Danielle Katterberg.
Dennis Brazzo.
Jenny Taylor.
Go Jazz. Jenny Wang.
Kirsten Stromberg.
Lara Bradbury.
Missy Schubert.
Rachel Barbosa.
Sarah Morris.
Thank you, Sarah. Sylvia the Shore.
Karen from Canada, the Winehouse.
Anna Tracy.
Christina Scambato.
Christine Anderson.
Diana Becker.
Emily Thornton.
Emily Toledo.
Aaron Posick.
Gabe Lozano.
Ian Sini, who's a mighty fine dancer, even though he didn't think he was.
Yeah, thanks for actually dancing with us, Ian. High five. And he wore the outfit, too. That was so fun. Ileana Bell Ruiz.
My favorite oldest sister-in-law.
Jamie Aliota.
My mother.
Jenny Barrow.
Jocelyn Milo.
The fancy lady Joy Kirsch.
Katie Radcliffe.
Kara Skara.
Lori Farrington.
Our esteemed dance instructor that's going to get us some tank tops with Dwayne on them. Marie Hoffman.
Marjorie Lewis.
Mary McGowan.
Peter Rukavina.
Sarah Kennedy.
Shannon Helm.
Sunshine Haven.
Tammy Schwartz.
Tara Wallace. Valerie Not Next to Normal Packer.
And Tartan Wendy.
Oh, some Scottish vibes.
Yes.
Grab your bagpipes.
Just FYI, Wendy helps us with our social media, so we are giving her a special shout out today. Thank you so much, Wendy.
Aw, that was so precious. I like to burn things.
If you'd like to join us in the Patreon, we would love your support to keep the podcast going. We hope the podcast is helpful for you, and we're trying to reach as many people as we can. In that vein, if you'd like to go to iTunes and give us a rating and review, we would mucho appreciate that. That also helps people to be able to find us.
Yes, we just did a giveaway as well. So congrats to Stephen Schubert and
Marianne Farnsworth. If you guys have not emailed us with your addresses yet, which I don't think you have, email us so we can send you your gift cards. Clap, 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 clap.
Yay, applause, 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 applause. And for those that are listening to this episode on Monday and Tuesday until midnight, the store for the t-shirts will be open until then. It closes at midnight at the end of the day on the 15th. So get
your shirts while you can.
Thank you again to Kirsten. Remember how we were talking about dancing being helpful for the brain and being helpful to get some different memories going and the juices flowing for better mental health?
Yes.
Well, you know what also is good for mental health? You get two guesses or one.
Okay, I was going to say dogs, which you will agree to.
I agree.
But the second one is going to be therapy.
Yes! Yes. If you do not have a therapist and you are scared about finding one or don't know how to go about it, we have great news.
So if you're looking for a therapist or you're looking to change your therapist or you just feel like you need some additional support in your life right now, we have a partnership with BetterHelp, and you can go onto their website, you answer a few questions, and they match you with a therapist who specializes in your needs. If you don't jive with them, you can request a new one and get some help.
Yes, it's pretty great. I actually am a client of BetterHelp because I wanted to see how everything runs and if it's beneficial to do it online. And I am happy to say that I've been doing it for over a year. When I first signed up, I was matched with a therapist in less than 24 hours. I love my therapist. We clicked really well. But in the event that you do not click with your therapist, it's easy to switch and you can just do it online. You can be an introvert and kind of do it incognito. So there are lots of benefits to doing it online. There are even therapists that are certified in EMDR that can offer that even though it is online. So for those of us who are in trauma, we need the EMDR.
Which is all of us, I think.
Yes, I think everybody for sure. Go ahead and check it out. So our specific link is trybetterhelp.com/WWDN. And we always link to this in the show notes every single episode. So if you're not sure how to access the show notes, if you're looking at your phone for the podcast episode, you just scroll down all the way to the bottom, and then that's where the show notes are. So there are links there. Get some therapy. It will help you. It will help your life. And you can do it while you're in your pajamas.
And it's not no shirt, no shoes, no service kind of a situation.
I think all you have to do is wear a shirt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably
Or turn
reasonable.
Off your camera. I mean, you do you. It's fine.
Again, the link is trybetterhelp. That's HELP.com/WWDN.
All right, shall we get to the episode, Anita?
I think that we should. I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
We're just two young widows trying to figure out and trying to help you figure out widow. We do now. Mel.
Yes?
We've already had a great time talking to our guest, so I don't even think we need to continue. I think we can just tell people it was awesome. And to go find her.
We're done. And we want to keep this guest all to ourselves because she's so much fun. But because she is so much fun, I think we need to share her with the widow world.
Yes. So this is Jennifer O'Brien. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello. So good to be here.
We have gotten permission to call her a few names and we will spread them out throughout the interview. But Jenny is not one of them.
No.
That's already been established. Thanks for joining us.
It is my pleasure. I love you guys. I love listening to you. I love you. I love the name of this podcast. I was telling my neighbor about it this morning and she's like, oh my God, that is so cute. It really is.
Jennifer, where are you recording from? Sometimes we assume that unless we had a huge life insurance payout, we don't really need to know anything about investments or even finances. But guess what? A little knowledge of finances is critical for all of us. Maybe your partner was in charge of that stuff, and now you find yourself making all the decisions. Maybe you're mad about that. Maybe I am. Nicole from the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast is here to help. She tackles financial literacy by telling the stories of women and widows and finance experts and shares the lessons they've learned as certified financial planners. Whether you know a lot and feel confident in your financial decisions or feel unsure about all of that stuff, there is more to learn. Listen and subscribe to the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast on all podcast platforms. This ad was paid for by Rockhouse Financial, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
I am coming to you from downtown Little Rock, Arkansas.
Oh, really? I think I'm on a roll. I played for Colin Ray for 3 years, who wrote the song Little Rock. So
Nice.
Not that that has anything to do with this episode.
Are you from Little Rock?
I am not from Little Rock.
You don't sound like you're from Little Rock.
I know. That's a giveaway, isn't it? And that actually is kind of part of the story. So if we want to dive right in, I can do that. Yeah. So I have been in healthcare on the business side for 34 years. I like to say I started when I was 10, but that's a lie. but anyway, 34 years of teaching doctors the business and leadership side of their practices. And so one of the things I do is weave actually leading practices and then doing some consulting, right? So I came down to Little Rock, Arkansas from Chicago. I've lived several places. Chicago, I've lived several times. Came down from Chicago to be an interim CEO of a very large orthopedic surgery practice. Right? It was 25 orthopedic surgeons.
That is huge.
I know, right? Couple hundred employees, and they needed some change. And my master's degree is in organizational change, and my background is in practice management. So I came down to be their CEO for what was supposed to be 2 to 3 years, you know, kind of turn the battleship, hire my replacement, go back to Chicago. Yeah. That's right. I was actually kind of commuting. I would go back to Chicago frequently for the weekends or whatever. And one weekend, I stayed here in Little Rock and I went to an art opening at a gallery here in town. And I met this guy and his name was Bob Lemberg, and he had been a plastic and reconstructive surgeon for 30 plus years. And at one point, which is important because I worked with a lot of plastic surgeons, I worked with a lot of surgical specialties, so we knew people in common. But he had also had a neck injury that prevented him from operating. So he chose to retrain in hospice and palliative care. And by the time I met him, he was a hospice and palliative care physician at our university med center here in Little Rock. And I was a smitten kitten because, you know, it's a pretty special guy who can do plastic and reconstructive surgery very, very well, then chooses to retrain in hospice and palliative care. That's pretty amazing. I had already lost my only sibling and my mother. And so I knew how important hospice and palliative care was, right, to people and families that are dealing with serious illness and end of life. So yeah, so I fell hard and he did too. And we got married and it just had this wonderful life. He, like I said, worked hard on faculty at this med center, and I continued to do what I did for a couple of years. I finally did kind of get out of the orthopedic world, but we did have a wonderful, wonderful life. And then he found a couple lumps on the left side of his neck. We went through some diagnostics and determined that it was a stage 4 metastatic cancer. And so all of that wisdom and guidance that he had been providing for families and patients all those years, you know, now we were sort of turning that on ourselves.
Wow.
Yes, right? I mean, and I started an art journal as a form of self-care. I'm a self-taught collage artist, and I started this journal to sort of process what was happening to me because you know, I'd already lost a couple people. I knew how bad it was going to hurt. I knew what we were headed toward, and he did too, of course. So anyway, I kept the journal. He lived for 22 months following the diagnosis. We did a lot of things to prepare for his death and my survivorship, which was very loving, you know, very difficult and very loving of him to do all of that. And he died a comfortable, dignified death. And I still, you know, miss him every damn day. But I carried out all of his wishes in terms of things he wanted to give into people and so forth. And then I took another one of those interim CEO positions, right, at a large multi-specialty practice here in Little Rock. And I kept the journal, right? I kept going with the journal for about a year and a half after he died. So it has some grief kind of factor in there too. And so I'm working with this neurologist who tells me he's in the process of diagnosing three different patients with ALS, which is
Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yes, Lou Gehrig's, exactly. And so I bring in my journal to him and I said, you know, you might want to take a look at this. And he takes it home and he comes back and he says, Jennifer, you're not getting your journal back. I'm going to be loaning it to these patients and their spouses because your journal is incredibly helpful and you need to figure out how to get this thing published so that it can be made available to people. Cause it helps, you know, it helps fill a gap between what the physician can provide for the patient and what the family caregiver in the picture really needs, right? There's a big gap there. And this book apparently speaks to a lot of that, which is understandable considering that's the role I was playing. And we were very educated in what we were going through, and it was still incredibly difficult, right? So anyway, so I went to work on that, and I found a small press based here in Little Rock that was willing to take a chance on it, and we published it. It was released 3 weeks before the pandemic shut everything down.
Of course.
We had this fabulous party at the art gallery where Bob and I met. The art that was in the book is I had printed and was hanging in the gallery. We drank obituary cocktails. We ate.
What? Right? Stop. Pause. Yes. Stop. We need more information on obituary cocktails.
Go.
Tell us.
Right. So I lived in New Orleans for 7 years during one of those things where I was working and trying to figure life out. And
interiming?
Yes, interiming. And an obituary cocktail has absinthe and, well, a traditional obituary cocktail, true and true, has several different alcohols in it. The one that I sort of created, that I settled on for this party, because after all, I'm in Little Rock, Arkansas, was the sort of classic where you fill a clear glass with some absinthe. You take a flat slotted spoon and lay it on top of the glass with a sugar cube on the slotted spoon, and you pour cold water over the sugar cube. And as it goes in to the absinthe, it turns this milky, slightly light green, but mostly whitish, you know? And I think it's delicious. It's quite potent, but I like absinthe. I think it's a delicious beverage. We also served a wine from a vineyard called Chronic Cellars, and every one of their labels has a Day of the Dead figure on it, right?
That's so cool.
Right. I had sort of some kind of a screen going with quotes and questions to promote discussion about end of life, because both Bob and I would contend that a good portion of the regret that happens when someone dies is somewhat preventable if we were just willing to talk about end of life. Now, I know that's not true in all cases. Sudden deaths, like I think that you're both unfortunately uniquely familiar with at a young age. Yeah, that's pretty hard. It's pretty hard to do it. But for most of us, being willing to talk about it ahead of time and sort of what we envision for what we want at the end of our lives and what we don't want can really help a lot. And when folks don't talk about that, you know, they get to that crucial point and they don't know what their loved one wanted. And so instead of the sadness, the pure sadness, love, and grief, you end up with all this, like, I should have, would have, could have, you know, all this other layered stuff.
Yeah, like you mentioned, Anita and I are sudden death widows. And so we are not as familiar with the end of life situation. I know one of my good friends, she was one of the guests on the podcast when we were first starting to interview guests. we knew her husband was dying because he had pancreatic cancer for like 4 years, right? And so they did everything they could to try and, I guess, mitigate some of the issues that would come up inevitably. And I remember after he died, they had major problems, like, with the hospice. Like, even up, like, I guess not even after, but up until his death, it was more traumatic than they were hoping. And so can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that people experience so that we can know about them? And, yeah, give us just some insight into what it's like to deal with the end of life and all of those things.
Sure, absolutely. So the first thing I would advise in all of this, and one of the reasons that Bob and I were able to handle it as well as we did, was to start having some conversations, ideally before anyone is ill or injured, right? So you might watch a movie or listen to a song that has a reference in it, right? And you would say, so, you know, what are you envisioning as far as like organ system support? You know, do you want to be on a ventilator? Do you want to, those kinds of things? Because at some point, a lot of times, and the story with Bob and I, of course, is that the first night we ever slept together, I mean, we're all adults here. The first night we ever slept together, it was fabulous, a fabulous night, beautiful dinner, the whole nine yards. We go to bed. It's wonderful in every possible way. And Bob sort of flops over and we're in the dark. I hear him say, well, if I have a heart attack, don't call the EMTs until I'm cold and blue.
Oh,
and right. So that is, and I can hear him kind of smiling in his voice. So that is telling me two things. One is that was some fabulous sex. And two is I've now got an idea of what his advanced healthcare directives are.
Two for one.
It was totally a twofer.
Do you suggest then that people have discussions of their advanced healthcare directives in that setting? Is that when the most convenient time to talk about it would be?
Interesting that you bring that up, because I will contend that talking about end of life and end of life wishes is one of the most intimate things you can do with someone. To be the one who knows what he wants and what he doesn't want, who can say to the hospice, you know, no, we're not bringing a hospital bed in here because I know what he wants and he doesn't want that. You know, to know that he wants palliative sedation, to know that he wants his niece to have this particular painting when he dies, to have taken the letters that he wrote to friends and family, you know, to have addressed them and taken them to the post office for him. I mean, seriously, does it get any more intimate than that? I don't think so. And so, you know, maybe that's the time, maybe that's not. It certainly happened to be the time for us. And it was partly, you know, the fact that I picked up on the advanced directive component was just part of who we were, you know. So yeah, it's an intimate thing.
Can we back up for just a second? Because I feel like I need more context. How old were you when you guys met? And how long were you married?
So we got, it's a little bit complicated, but it was under 5 years. And he was 18 years older than I.
Okay. I was wondering, because if he'd been a surgeon for that long and you're only 22, that was.
Yeah. Yes. I was 22 and he was 80. Yeah. No. No, I was in my late 40s. And because I remember I had my 50th birthday while he was sick. And like I said, he was 18 years older. Neither one of us ever had kids. Needless to say, we had both been married before and we were not virgins when we met. I do think that factors in to some degree, you know, but I think largely because I do think people tend to think I'm too young to think about talking to my loved one about end of life. I think that's a classic mistake. Basically, 18 and older, right? Yeah. You're responsible. If you have a bad accident, and somebody needs to make a decision on your behalf, boy, it is sure help. It's, first of all, it's not automatically your parents once you're 18 years old, right? It's your designated healthcare proxy. And so, people think they're too young to have these discussions, but I think they're not. I think this is a big, important, as the three of us know, in no uncertain terms, it is one of the biggest events of our life, right? So you get married, you have kids, maybe you don't have kids, maybe you don't get married, but everybody dies.
I was just thinking about this today. I was thinking, I wish there was a class that every high school kid had to take in high school that was what happens when people die and talking about death. And also in that class, I would like to add boundaries, emotional boundaries, teaching people emotional boundaries, you know, just stuff that's practical.
There is so much that could be taught in that class. That could be a full semester, no question, because when you think about things like advanced healthcare directives, you think about ethical right issues, you think about communication, you think about wills and other sorts of paperwork. And then the whole, at least the second half could be on grief. And how do you support, you know, I noticed you call the friends of grievers, grief civilians, which I think is a fabulous term, but that is such an important role. And I think for, you know, I endured it for the first time when I was 18, my brother was 13 when he died and I was 18. Yeah. And he was my only sibling and it was 1983 and we did not deal with grief and loss in 1983, as well as we do now, believe it or not, right? Some pretty crappy things happen to us now. It was crappier.
I believe it. Nobody would talk about anything.
No, nobody would talk about anything. And you were supposed to get over it. Like,
yep.
ASAP.
Bootstraps, yeah. Pull them up.
You don't get over the love for a sibling. You don't get over the love of a husband. Like, how are you supposed to get over the fact that they died? There's no getting over it.
Was this a sudden death, by the way?
It was he was in an accident. Yeah, so he was in a coma for 3 weeks before he died. So sudden, sort of, not entirely, right?
Yeah.
Well, and certainly out of order.
I think that one thing that is important about what we're talking about is having those conversations, like you said, before there's a diagnosis and before there's an injury. Because a lot of the people we've talked to, once that diagnosis hits, there's this feeling that a discussion like that opens the door, it seems like, and I'll say that in quotes, to inviting death. Like, if we talk about it, then we've quote unquote given up. Or, you know, we're not even going to see that possibility. We're going to blind ourselves.
Well, yeah, I think you make an excellent point that if you've had the conversation before anybody gets sick or injured, then yeah, you're less inclined to have that. You're able to go back to those conversations as a point of reference. Are you still feeling? I mean, there was a point after Bob got sick where fairly early on he was getting treatment and we were able to, you know, have good times and he was able to continue working, which was his number one priority. And so things were pretty good. And I said to him, you know, are we still not calling the EMTs until you're cold and blue? Yeah. We're still not. I mean, you know, so it was just this reference point that I could check in and say, because the other thing that happens is you can have some pretty firm feelings about, I don't ever want to be on dialysis. I don't ever want to be on a ventilator. But you can also get an illness or an injury that if you were on dialysis for a period of time, or you have something important happening in your life and you want the dialysis to be able to see your grandbaby born or whatever, you know, whatever that important priority is that is different from when you initially said, none of this, none of this, none of this. All that advanced directives are, you know, and you really need to document them, and you really need to touch base periodically with your healthcare proxy to make sure they're still on board with carrying out your wishes. That's the other thing, Bob, and this was in my journal. Bob used to tell patients the story of his own parents who both lived into their 90s. His father, who was a physician also, said from very early on, the minute I show a sign of decline, keep me comfortable until I die. That's it, just comfort. His mother said, oh, no. Every possible life-extending measure. I want it all. And both of them were correct because your wishes are correct. There is no, mine or may not be good for you and vice versa. We don't judge other people's advanced healthcare directives. We just don't. And that way we have those discussions and it saves a lot of just consternation and guilt and confusion. And I mean, it's already a hard, hard thing. I mean, it's already sad and difficult. Why would we make it worse?
Because he was a hospice physician, did your dinner table conversations often revolve around death and dying because that was his day-to-day life? Did you hear a lot of just, you know, dinner table talk? That
sure.
Was...
So the specialty is actually palliative care. And okay. It's an important distinction because a lot of people think palliative care means death. It does not. When you get a big diagnosis like cancer or ALS or diabetes, often with that comes a lot of extra weight, right? Pain or other symptoms, side effects from treatments, psychosocial issues, right? You're now facing mortality sooner than maybe you were facing it before the diagnosis. Everyone's facing mortality, of course. But all these, there's just this layer of stuff and the whole family, right, gets this new member of this disease or this condition. And so palliative care is an interdisciplinary team of a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a chaplain, a social worker, sometimes a clinical pharmacist that help a patient and their family manage it. Sometimes for a short time and they go on and have a wonderful life or wonderful rest of their life. Sometimes that when there are no curative treatments or therapeutic treatments available anymore, then we say, okay, I want to just be kept comfortable, and we transition to a hospice status, and we do measures that just keep a person comfortable until they die.
This might be an obvious answer, but for those of us who don't know, how do you name somebody your healthcare proxy?
Right. So what you should probably do, so there's two options. The best thing to do is go to the Google, put in, you know, advanced healthcare directives and your state. And every state has some different either forms or regulations and so forth. So you want to get your states. And that's probably the most direct way to research it. I have a free downloadable asset that I call the At Peace Toolkit. And I would highly recommend that you both and anybody listening go to my website and download it because it's a three-step process that is, one is loading your medical ID on your smartphone and making it accessible even when your phone is locked. And that could actually save your life. You know, that's not just about end of life, that could save your life. So that's the first step. The second step is some thoughts on advanced healthcare directives and some instructions on where to go to set that up. And the third is sort of, you know, get your paperwork together. And here's some checklists to help you do that. Three steps, but man, once you do them, you know, that's some serious adulting that you've just accomplished there. And it's just liberating, right? It's liberating. I feel better about carrying on with life, getting back to life after the pandemic, because my stuff's in order and because I've taken certain precautions. So that would be another really easy way to do it.
My dad has this book in his office and it's the Green Book. And he says, when I get hit by the bus, or if your mom gets hit by the bus or whatever, everything's in that book.
Your dad's a smart man.
Yes. And when he first brought it up, I was like, oh my gosh, Dad, stop. And he brings it up like once every other month. He's just like, you know where that book is, right? Because, you know, when we get hit by the bus, I'm like, oh my gosh, please don't get hit by a bus. But it's comforting in a strange way, or I guess it lowers the stress because I know that he has his trust figured out and they've done all that they need to do to where things are in order for if something does happen, an accident, or if he gets a sudden illness and he's not well enough to then make appointments and do those directives, that it's taken care of. So,
well, and honestly, it's not really if, it's when.
When. Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Although maybe not the bus part.
Yeah, no. Maybe not the bus part, but the idea of at some point either being incapacitated or dying, that's a when, not an if, right?
Yeah. Yeah. On the flip side of Mel's experience, I have a grandpa, he's an old cowboy guy, and I somehow, through a complicated story, am in charge of him, sort of. And I try to talk to him about when he dies, and he only will say, you guys will figure it out. And I am like, it's so rude. I'm like, that's so rude. Everybody's going to be fighting. It's going to be this big, stupid deal. And he's like, oh, you'll figure it out. Oh, I had to like go and make him fill out an advanced healthcare directive. And it was like, he's 92.
I listened to your episode about self-care versus selfish.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you, your grandfather's being selfish there.
Do you know what my grandpa is? I love him dearly, but he's an ostrich.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has been since I have been his person. My grandma had Alzheimer's and he would just say, it will all work out. And I was like, it doesn't just work out. You know, like I had to get her driver's license taken away, which was horrible because he wouldn't do it. He was like, oh, everything's fine. And I was like, you have got to pull your head out of the sand.
When somebody dies and they don't have their things in order, not only is healthcare and those sorts of things kind of up in the air, but also how many family feuds have been started over stupid money and property. I have seen this. It's so common.
That's what's going to happen. I guarantee.
Yeah, you know, if there's no will, it automatically goes to probate, which is a state thing. And depending on what state you're in Arkansas, that'll cost 5% of the value of the estate. So right there, boom, 5% of the value gone because you didn't bother to, you know, get some stuff in order before you died, period. Now that's just the state probate costs. Then you have to hire some attorneys, right, to deal with that infighting that you've just described. You can end up having that estate value reduced by 30-40%.
Yeah.
In the blink of an eye because of that's crazy. That's just bad business.
Secretly, I'm just trying to get him to spend all his money before he dies so we don't have to deal with that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a wise move.
Sometimes, like if a parent is the one that dies, the parent is the glue that keeps things kind of copacetic. And then, boom, now they can be like in a fight and there's super bad feelings or people fight over possessions, like dumb stuff.
Yeah.
And only 1 in 3 adults in the U.S. have a will.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Well, he does have a will,
good,
FYI, which was another whoa thing to go through. But we did get that. And basically says, sell everything and split it. I'm like, thanks. I'm like, is there anything in here that you want to give to a certain person? No, you'll figure it out. I'm like, whoa. Ostrich.
He also had like no headstone for 7 years, right?
Yes.
For your grandma. That was the same grandpa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I can't really be critical of that. I've still got
me neither. It's ironic.
Okay. Do you not have one? Yeah. What did you do for Bob? Or what did he want done?
So Bob told me that, so my brother is buried in Talpa, New Mexico. And when my mother died, she wanted to be cremated. So I took her ashes out and scattered them over my brother's grave. And Bob and I went and visited there once and had a wonderful trip there. And it's in a weird place, but once you get there, you're like, I mean, Bob kept saying as we were driving there, he's like, why did your parents bury him here? And I'm kind of shrugging. I don't know, you know, it's whatever. I don't know. And then when we got there, he was like, oh, I get it. And because it's just rustic northern New Mexico, which it has its own beauty. Anyway, so Bob told me, I want to be cremated. I want you to take my ashes out to David's grave and scatter them like you did with your mother's. He said, there is no rush. You can take as long as you want to do it. And but he did say, because since we're having these confessions, I didn't actually put a marker for my mother. My brother has a beautiful, beautiful headstone. I never actually got around to doing a marker for my mother's ashes. So he said, I'm going to want you to put a marker there for my ashes. And I was like, of course. And I will do it for my mother at the same time. And I've got a plan.
When Bob was diagnosed, did he immediately go to like preparation for death? Or was there a period of that like, we're going to beat this, this is going to be fine? Did he have any of the, I would say, normal feelings surrounding death? Or was he so like used to kind of doing this that he went straight into like, this is what we're going to do, this is what I want, and that kind of thing? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
It's a very good question. It makes perfect sense. It's actually in the book a couple of times, and it's some advice that I learned from an oncologist I worked with years ago. Because make no mistake, even when you're in the business, right, of delivering that kind of news to patients and their families for decades, that doesn't give you some pass that you don't, you know, you don't, that doesn't mean that you suddenly know how to handle it yourself. It's just a fact. It's a big deal. But this physician that I worked with years ago is a lung cancer specialist. Oh, wonderful doctor. And what he would say to patients at every visit is, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And that was advice I took to heart with me and Bob. And the thing that I think is important about it is repeating it frequently. That needs to ring in your head. Hope for the best and prepare for the worst. The best and the worst change. So at the very beginning, when we thought there was, in fact, a targeted therapy, because there are now some really interesting targeted therapies that can undo, I mean, Jimmy Carter, 90 plus years old, has a metastatic melanoma of the brain, but finds a targeted the targeted therapy that works on his particular cancer, and he's cured, right?
It's because he's the president.
But it's happened to non-presidents.
Okay. I was just saying, like, if you're that special, then they like make up new things for you.
Yeah.
So just get elected and then you're fine.
That was okay. Bob's problem. He was not, he was never president. Anyway. So at first you're sort of like, yeah, why not us? Why wouldn't we find a targeted therapy and this could all be reversed? And so that's the hope for the best part. And the worst is death. And then, okay, we don't have a targeted therapy. And so the best becomes really good quality time and Bob being able to work, and the worst becomes suffering, and the worst becomes, right? And so, but we're always preparing for what's ahead. And what's ahead, even if you do get the targeted therapy and you do get the cure, you're still going to die at the end of your life. And I don't think there is such a thing as someone feeling like they were too prepared.
It's better to be over-prepared than under-prepared.
It doesn't hasten death. You're still going to die when you're going to die, whether you prepare for it or whether you don't. So you might as well prepare for it.
Oh, man. J2.
Yes.
I'm curious about your collage art. What does that mean?
Yes.
Well, for starters, it means that I'm not good at painting or drawing.
Okay.
So, interestingly enough, when I took my mother's ashes out to my brother's grave in 2004, I did that by myself because I was dating a guy who was a jerk and broke up with me right before the trip. Yes, we don't like him. Anyway, and so I went by myself and I ended up going to this little workshop. First of all, taking a trip by yourself is not the worst thing in the world if you're in a frame of mind that you can handle it, because I got to do whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. And one of the things I wanted was to go to this art journaling workshop, which I didn't even know what art journaling was. And so we sort of talked about, you know, taking a book and gluing some stuff in it and writing some stuff in it. And then I got home from that trip and I realized, oh, that's why I've been saving all these little funny scraps of paper and tickets from old shows and so forth. So I started gluing stuff together, and then I kind of didn't really want to close the book. So I started creating, right, these standalone collages or frameable collages, or in one case, I made a Christmas collage that actually ended up being accepted by the Art Institute of Chicago's gift shop as one of their Christmas cards one year. Who knew?
Cool. And,
right. I know. Right. So I started doing the making stuff. And then about the time that Bob got sick, I decided I wanted to teach myself how to do it on the computer. So how to do digital collage.
Oh.
So yeah. So the journal is done in digital collage.
What I'm imagining is, remember when you were in elementary school and they would bring in the magazines and you would like clip out the things and then like paste them, and they'd say like, please don't bring Marie Claire magazines because
the women are too sexy.
Those are probably not great collage materials for fourth graders.
Right. Yeah, kind
that's
of.
That's what you do.
It's a lot of, well, in my case, in my analog traditional collage, I use a lot of, those are a little bit flatter. So I do a little bit more assemblage work. Sometimes I had a series of single earrings, right? I've lost the earring. And so I do a little fetish kind of thing with the single earring, you know, stuff like that.
Oh, cool. So like not just using like flat things, like using objects.
Objects, yes. A little bit more of assemblage type work, that when you use 3D objects, it's tends to be called assemblage. And kind of layering things and using lots of different textures. I like to use some of that flaky, like gold leaf stuff. One of the things I think you've talked about on other program, other shows, and that I think maybe we'll want to talk about here is kind of what are some of the coping mechanisms that we all, or that I engage in anyway. I don't know if we all do it, but I just gave a talk to an organization called Soaring Spirits, which is an organization of widows worldwide, Soaring Spirits International. And it was about making, and that I find a lot of healing in creating art or making stuff. And so I shared with them that really that's kind of started almost from when my brother died, not quite that far back, but almost. And each time it's sort of taken a development turn. And most recently, you know, it's not always just fancy stuff that gets published in books. I really love making these. I love making cards, you know, doing a little collage on a note card, because I love sending cards. If I feel crummy, like blue, one of the fastest ways I can make myself feel better is writing notes to my friends and family and just telling them I love them. I guess it's kind of selfish in a way, because it's ultimately making me feel better, but it's also kind of nice because it makes them feel good.
It's symbiotic.
Yeah.
It's good for the goose and good for the gander. I've never known what that means, but...
What's a gander?
It's a male goose.
Male goose.
Oh, gross. Okay, anyway. Anyway, I think it's awesome because not only are you sending that card to your loved one, but you're creating something unique for them. And it's so interesting because art therapy is something that's used a lot in healing of trauma with PTSD and all sorts of things. And so there's so many benefits to it. Like, not just, you know, of course it makes our mood feel better, but like even just the neuroplasticity of the brain and using different techniques and opening up those new pathways, it helps the brain to be able to imagine something different than what it already is in. And imagination is something that's helpful for people to move through grief better, or to imagine a new life for themselves, or help themselves get unstuck.
Or even identify the trauma and start to, you know, claim it and process it. That I lived in New Orleans and left 2 years before Katrina. And so I still had a lot of very close friends. And I went back to New Orleans 3 months after the storm. And it was devastating to see it, because all those homes that were on the lakefront that had to be razed, those people all have to empty their homes before the home can be razed. And so there was this one like football field size property that had probably what was the equivalent of a 4-story building of stuff from people's homes, couches and dolls and swings and all baby stuff, all this stuff. And it was all muddy, and it was traumatic. I mean, I didn't live through it. I just saw it 3 months later, and that was traumatizing. And when I got back, at the time I was living in Chicago, I got back and someone suggested to me, you know, why don't you collage it? You know, because I couldn't get over it. I was like, I was just, yeah. So I did. I created this collage, and it just really helped like kind of get it out of my system, get the trauma part out of my system, the debilitating part.
So the book that you've written, which, may I just throw in, just won a major award. It has one of those silver stickers on the front, which you cannot purchase. You must win those silver stickers.
Yes.
What's the award that it won?
It won a Nautilus Book Award, a silver Nautilus Award.
Which is one step below the Pulitzer Prize.
Okay, no, but but you are my new best friend, even for imagining that that's true.
Okay, I used art therapy to imagine it. So this book that you wrote, I'm curious if it's designed more for people who are going through the process of somebody that they love dying or themselves dying, or if it's more for the after somebody has died, or it's both or none, or what? Who's your book for?
You know, my book is for family caregivers and grievers. So it is a very help. If you have a friend whose mother or husband has just been diagnosed with a very serious life-limiting illness, you want to buy them this book and give it to them. I have also had people who gave the book to a widow, because the title of the book is The Hospice Doctor's Widow, a Journal. And so that has led a lot of people to think it's a grief book, which it is. I would say easily 1/3 of it is from after Bob died. And so people who have received the book after their loved one has died, either because the book wasn't published before their loved one died or someone gave it to them after, have found it very helpful, both in some of the grieving and in validating some of the feelings they had while their loved one was ill. So either one, I mean, it's really both family caregivers and grievers. Those are the two groups that I identify with the most and feel like my experience and my book, you know, help the most.
Do you feel like we were just talking about creating the creation of the book. Was that another way that you were able to process and kind of dig into your grief and your experience and kind of move through that?
Yes, is the simple answer to the question. It allows me to stay close with Bob in what I believe is a healthy, reasonable way to stay close with, right? Someone I love and loved. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I still, especially when I'm doing an interview like this, I wear my wedding ring and I wear this watch because Bob gave me both of these, and I want him with me when I'm talking to folks like you, that, and we're the three of us trying to process some stuff in a way that will help other people. I think he was wise, and he did amazing work in this field, and I love him and I want him with me. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Doesn't necessarily mean I don't ever want to date another man again. It doesn't, it's nothing like, there's none of that to read into it. It's just a fact.
I love the idea, though, because in a way, I mean, the story, the book, doesn't happen without him. And so it's kind of like you want to keep him in on it. Otherwise, you're just kind of using him. Have you ever thought about it that way?
Yeah.
I mean,
certainly. Yes, I think that is an interesting point. I have never, well,
I'm not really, I was joking about the using him part, but I mean, you do want to invite him in because he was an integral part of the whole process.
Well, not only that, Anita, but several of the things I documented in the book that people find the most helpful were things that he used to do in his practice. So I told you about his parents and how he used that as an explanation. There was another term that he would say to people. He would tell people, you're into precious time. Precious time is when you say what you need to say and you don't say what you will later regret. And that was his way, in a very sort of gentle, you know, somewhat Southern and colloquial expression, to say, this person is dying. And he always used to say, not to patients, but to me and to colleagues, I've seen death thousands of times. It's peaceful. The patient is going to be fine. It's the family I worry about. And that's when he was telling families, you're into precious time. In other words, this doesn't go on forever, right? So do what you need to do. Say what you need to say. Don't say what you don't need to say. Right? So that you can go on and have a healthy survivorship. So there's a lot of his wisdom in there. There's, you know, at one point, there's a book, a page called Treatment Decisions. Bob, as a physician, would decide whether, I mean, he was on several different chemotherapies over the 22 months, right? As a physician, he would go through a very different decision-making process than you and I would go through on, should I try this chemotherapy or not? And so I took what I saw as his process and put it in layperson's terms, right? You know, first know what this treatment is doing. Is it curing you? Is it prolonging your life? Is it palliative? You know, next thing, right? And kind of just these quick and dirty, not quick and dirty, that's probably... it's probably not ideal language.
That's,
but
that's our lingo.
How about really simplifying?
Right. Thank you. Yes. Simplifying that decision, that very important decision-making process, and taking it out of his doctor language and into our language. So yes, he's a big part of this book. For the most part, I feel like he's with it. You know, when you've worked in medicine for 34 years, in medicine, we stay in our lane. You have a license, you have qualifications to do something, or you defer to the person who does, right? Nurses don't do things that doctors are licensed to do, and right? So, and certainly people like me don't do that. So we're all very sensitive to staying in our lane. I don't worry that I'm branching out into his, because I'm never going to give somebody medical advice. I'm going to tell our story because it's a story that helps other people.
I love this idea, and I need to see the book. I have not seen it.
Oh,
especially
okay.
To see the well, I mean, in person, I want to look through all the pages and things like that, because I'm so fascinated by it.
Yes, yeah, so but one of the things that's really cool about it is it's 8x10, and it's 85 pages, and it's premium color. And it's a lot of art, so it's very manageable. A book about a really heavy, huge, big thing, ends up being totally manageable for even the person who's going through it, right? You can open it up and read a couple pages and kind of put it down for a while. I've had people tell me they keep it on their coffee table because it's pretty. And I've been asked, am I going to do an ebook or am I going to do a paperback? No, because this is, you need to hold this book. It's a big part of what it is. So yes, you need to experience the book.
I know that like having ebooks is so convenient, but there's something about holding the actual book. Like it has its own life and just touching it, like it's such a different experience and it's so helpful. So I love that. I hope that someday we get to see it.
Yes.
And touch it.
Where do we get your book if we wanted to get your book?
You could get my book on Amazon.
What?
I know.
It's okay.
Crazy. But Amazon actually has it on sale right now.
Really?
I know.
But wait, when will it end? When will the sale end?
I don't know because it's Amazon and they, you know, sort of do what
they just
want
make it up?
Yes.
Oh, weird.
Okay, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to link to it in the show notes and y'all can figure out how to get it. How about that?
Yes. You can get it on Amazon. You can connect through, or my website can connect directly to the publisher.
Is there one way where you get more of the money?
No.
Yeah. Dang it.
Believe me, if I could give this book to everybody who needs it, I would do that. I mean, I think it's just important to have it.
I'm feeling right now a little bit of sadness almost and regret because we have had widows who have just recently lost their husbands. And it's like, dang it, they needed this book like 2 months ago, 3 months ago or whatever.
Well,
and
they might have, but I do think there's quite a bit in the book because I had the experience of losing my brother nearly 40 years ago. There's some good grief material in the book that I probably actually understood better than Bob did because interestingly, despite the fact that he was older, he had never lost anybody except his parents who both lived into their 90s. I mean, which really, that doesn't even count. I mean, it does.
That's the expected.
Yeah. But at some point, yeah, you're like, okay, you're in your 90s. So if I could say something to those very recent widows, one of the things that is in the book that I learned when I was a very recent widow is that, so I read somewhere this notion of the one day at a time, right? So people say things like, oh, one day at a time. But the truth is when you're in the throes of acute grief, looking ahead at getting through just this one day at a time can be insurmountable, right? Like, I don't think I can get through the next 10 minutes, much less the next full day. So I learned at some point in that acute grief period, I read somewhere or something to sort of do that same one day at a time thing, but do it retrospectively. So in the evening, and I will still do this on a really difficult day. I did this on Sunday night after Mother's Day. Mother's Day was very hard for me this year.
Me too.
And what it is you look back in the evening and you say, you know what? I did it. I got through another day. Yay me.
That is such good advice.
Isn't that powerful? I was like blown away when I made that discovery in probably the first couple months after Bob died.
How long ago did he die?
4 years.
Okay. So 4 years. How's your life right now?
My life is pretty good. I don't have to tell either of you that going through a global pandemic as a relatively recent widow is just
stupid.
In a word, sucks.
Yes.
But it's pretty good. I'm in pretty good shape, I think. I think it works out. It's I still, like I said, Sunday was still really hard. Still have really bad days. I am still most likely to get some, what do they call it? Sudden traumatic upsurge of grief.
Oh.
Yeah. You're likely to get that at the grocery, you know, for whatever reason. I never liked going to the grocery, but for whatever reason, when I was going and shopping for two, you know, there was something great about that. And now I go to the same grocery that we always went to where I picked up Bob's prescriptions. And And there will be moments in that store where I'm just like, okay, I got to wrap this up. I got to get the essentials and get out of here. That still happens. And I don't know when that's ever going to go away or if it will, but.
Yeah. The grocery store is a weird place, man.
It is a weird place.
Mel.
What?
Do you have an important question?
I do. J2. What is your favorite cheese? Do you eat cheese?
You eat cheese.
Okay.
I eat a lot of cheese. I love cheese.
What kinds? Obituary cheese?
Well, it's funny. In addition to the obituary cocktails, we ate funeral food.
What's funeral food in Arkansas?
So, you know, so it's fried chicken. And I mean, I thought about serving casseroles and corningware with like masking tape on the bottom, but I wasn't quite tacky enough to do that. Okay. But there were several desserts made with Jell-O and Cool Whip.
Yes.
You know? Yes.
I mean, this is comfort food. And so, yeah, so we did everything basically that would stimulate the conversation about death. And yes, I love cheese. Might be easier to identify cheese.
Top three.
Or bottom three.
You're welcome.
I love an aged Gouda. I like a soft, mild cheese in the Brie family. And then I'm going to go ahead and throw this out there, get wacky with it. But I like a really good American cheese for a grilled cheese sandwich.
Mm. Yes, I agree. Oh, yep. It makes the grilled cheese amazing. Like, it makes the texture so good.
So good. So good.
I support this.
Yes. Good.
I also like putting cream cheese in the grilled cheese sandwich with American cheese and a harder cheese. Now you're going to try it. Yep. You're welcome.
Yes.
You're welcome, everyone.
Jennifer, you have been a delight to talk to. We really appreciate all you have had to share with us, and we can't wait to get our hands on your book.
I think we're doing a giveaway, and we're going to include a book, a copy of The Hospice Doctor's Widow, as well as some of the swag that comes from page 32.
So we will have instructions on how you can enter the giveaway to get Jennifer's book and some swag from page 32. It will be on Instagram, likely, so keep your eyes out for that.
Remember to join our Widow Wives Club on Facebook, answer the questions, and if you have a hard time, email us at widowwedonow@gmail.com.
Also, just email us at widowwedonow@gmail.com just to tell us how much you love our podcast and how sad you are. We want to hear about that.
Send us a picture of your animals if you have them.
And make sure you give us a rating and review so more people can find us who are just like you.
Remember to join our Patreon if you so desire. We have 4 tiers and they start at $5. And it helps us to keep the podcast going, which then helps more widows and helps us grievers.
You can buy us a taco at buymeacoffee.com/widowwedonow. Until we talk to you next time, I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
And I'm J2.
And we're 2 young widows and 1 artist who can't draw or paint, but can collage. And we're trying to figure out
Widow We Do Now. This is my favorite thing to discuss with you.
Tell me, what is it?
One of my favorite things. I do enjoy tacos and cheese and dogs. This is about how you cannot pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a phone plan, especially when you're a widow, your person is dead, you might have kids, you might need another option, and you just want your phone to work, you want unlimited texting and service, and you want it to be like $25 a month.
It blows my mind that they have plans that start at $15 a month. That is so cheap. And the cool thing is it uses other 5G networks, and so you don't have to pay extra for that, and you still get great service.
Yep. Anita and I have traveled all over, and I have used my phone. So I highly recommend it. And my mom's even on it. When my dad died, we put his phone down to the cheapest plan, which is $15 a month. And I think my mom's on the $20 a month plan, and it's so worth it. It's so much cheaper than what we were all paying before. So I highly recommend it if you're on a budget or not. Who cares? Ryan Reynolds is in charge of the company, and they send you free stickers with Ryan Reynolds temporary tattoos. It's kind of the best. So if somebody wants to sign up, what can they do, Anita?
Go to trymintmobile.com/WWDN. Seriously, you guys, such a great idea. Save yourself some money.
And if you're worried about losing data or having any changes with your phone, not going to happen. They walk you through it. Everything's fine. It's the easiest process of all time. Again, that's
trymintmobile.com/WWDN.